Amy, give us a synopsis of your life in music before the release of your first solo album that maybe might mention The Last Roundup and The Shams.
Okay. Well, it would have to start with classic rock and being a music fan growing up in Pittsburgh, going to see Elton John at Civic Arena and, you know, just seeing some pretty, those big shows that they had in the 70s. Peter Frampton and Pink Floyd, David Bowie. And then I moved to New York City and started going to punk shows in CBGBs and Max's, like these little clubs. And so that kind of, you know, I suddenly went from being a fan to feeling more like part of a scene, but was too shy. And I didn't think I really had a role to play as far as like getting up on stage at that point.
Are you doing this with girlfriends or with musician friends? Or who was with you at the time?
I had a boyfriend when I went to New York to go to art school. And at the time, my school, Parsons, didn't have dorms. We lived at NYU dorms. You know, this was New York in the 70s, a pretty dangerous, lawless place. And so I was lucky to meet someone. Like, you kind of needed a guide to take you to these places. And, you know, Bob took me to CBGB's for the first time. And once I'd been there once, I felt like, you know, I knew the way. And friends from Parsons went, and, you know, he just kind of went with whoever. And just kind of started going all the time to see shows, and that kind of went on for a couple of years. And one of my brothers came to Parsons to go to school too, and he and I and a bunch of friends started a club, like a dance party, together in a basement on St. Mark's Place, and that sort of went through a couple different locations, and then ended up in a club down in Tribeca, which was just a no man's land back then, and called Tier 3. And a friend's sister was a waitress in this failing restaurant, and the owners were like, you know, could you like get us some, bring your friends here, let's start having music here. So she started booking bands, and it turned into like a really great club, right around the time that the Mud Club was opened down in that part of town. Like, other than that, no one really had any reason to go down there at night. It was very much a like office worker kind of place. And I mean, it's so hard, you know, to imagine now, like as I walk around New York City, it's just so hard to imagine what it was like when it was just so deserted. In a lot of these neighborhoods at night, there just was like nothing, and nobody lived down there. And so it was just really kind of like our own little place. And and got to see a lot of the British punk bands that I looked up to, like the and girl groups like the Slits and the Raincoats came and played. So that was really kind of inspiring to me. And at that point, my brother and I started a no wave band where I played drums and he played bass. And yeah, I always forget about that band because we literally, I think we had like two shows, maybe three. We never put out a record or anything like that, but we, it was called the Stair Kits. And yeah, and Bob was the guitar player, my friend from CBGB's, and a woman named Angela Yeager, whose sister was the waitress who brought us all down there. So it was very much, it was a small world back then. It really was just like a small world of music fans and bands, and everybody seemed to know everybody. So that eventually turned into Last Roundup, which was kind of, it was a shift because we were playing no wave music and wearing like black eyeliner and, you know, looked really kind of that punky, I guess. And Last Roundup was a total, we called ourselves an urban hillbilly band. So there was like 3 years in between these things where basically it felt like punk kind of turned into new wave, and that didn't seem that interesting. and seemed, you know, kind of more like commercial pop music. And so started discovering old records then, looking into country music, finding records in thrift stores and flea markets, and mostly just like the covers were the record covers were what kind of attracted me to them, you know, just like a picture of Dolly Parton, you know, just like with a headscarf and, you know, just looking sure. really cool and interesting in these old clothes that, you know, I was always going to thrift stores and looking for interesting clothes. And so it was sort of the style.
Well, clothes are part of the scene.
Yeah.
That's what kind of attracts you to it all,
yes,
right?
Yes. And when I started listening to country records, all of a sudden I just started writing songs. It was like it had never really occurred to me when I was listening to all the punk bands that I loved, but the country stories felt like the stories that I liked to read. I loved reading like Raymond Carver and Bobby Ann Mason and Flannery O'Connor, and I just loved reading fiction, and they felt like these little stories in 3 minutes, and that just like snapped into focus for me.
As you looked at these punk bands, was it kind of easy to say to yourself, well, geez, I could write lyrics at least as good as that?
Oh, never. I thought the lyrics were brilliant, brilliantly direct in their simplicity, and there wasn't anything inflated about it. It was very direct. It was very to the point. It was energy and passion and, you know, just like all these physical things condensed into a few words. And then volume and just kind of, you know, power of and sometimes dissonance and, you know, things where you know, a band would stop a song and you'd go like, am I supposed to clap now? Is this you couldn't, you know, I liked being knocked off balance like that. I liked, and I love pop music, and I love, you know, the beauty and symmetry of a verse and a chorus and a bridge and a verse and a chorus, you know, but I think, and I had a sort of deep love and understanding of pop songs from the time I was really young, you know, that was just like really satisfying and important to me. But I loved how punk just kind of like knocked all that out of the way, and you could kind of do what you wanted.
Great answer.
As long as it was sort of interesting, you know, as long as you like kept people interested, it didn't have to be good. It didn't have to be, you know, technically good.
Yes, good by somebody else's standards.
Yes, exactly. It made up its own rules, and that, you know, that felt like really freeing and important. And it was great to be a teenager at that time, you know, because that's what you want when you're a teenager. You want to just like break the rules and do something, you know, that your parents would detest. that was what was great about that.
Well, that was 1987 that you were in the last roundup, and you had a release called Twister, which I couldn't find anywhere, so I couldn't listen to it. But then you eventually became a member of the Shams.
Yes.
Which had releases in 1990 and 1993. I do want to get to your solo stuff, but let's figure out how they fit in.
Well, I want to say the time that it would take back in those days to get a record together, it just took a lot more time, and you had to know somebody who knew someone who had a studio or get some money. You know, nowadays it's so much more possible to just kind of start recording as soon as you have the idea of writing something and putting it out there. But Last Roundup existed from 1983 to, you know, like it took us 4 years.
Wow.
It took us 4 years of recording. We went to Nashville, made a whole album that never came out. You know, just like played so many shows in New York City before we ever even like, none of us had a driver's license for one, but like, because it was New York and you didn't need a car. So, you know,
right.
It took a couple years before we even left the city to like go play a gig outside of, you know, Manhattan. But so it just took a while to, and when we started, we were like super primitive. And then there was, I think when we made our album that got shelved, we were sort of becoming proficient, but we weren't like all the way good yet. So like we went from being, you know, so it was just sort of like it took a while to get to a different level where it actually made sense as a record. Some of the early members of Last Roundup, Sue Garner and Amanda Uprichard, who kind of, you know, went off to do their own things early on and never were, you know, weren't on any of the recordings we made. But they were doing Christmas caroling around the city, and I started singing with them, doing that every year. We'd like, you know, knock on a friend's, well, we'd ring a buzzer of an apartment building and go climbing up the stairs singing our kind of wacky versions of Christmas songs, sort of like the Roaches did. They're kind of known for their early caroling efforts, and that turned into the Shams. Somebody saw us. Someone saw us at a Christmas party and said, "Oh, you know, could you come and like sing some songs at my little kid's birthday party?" And so we worked.
The Shams
up,
were more vocals, more about
yeah,
vocals.
We were vocals, and at first I just played acoustic guitar, and then Sue's a good musician. She started playing bass, and I was writing. You know, by then, like my brother and I had split songwriting in last roundup. He'd written half the songs, and I'd written half the songs. We never co-wrote. We never collaborated in that way, but we just bring in our separate songs. But the Shams became like a great outlet for all the like hundreds of songs that I was writing and putting on cassettes. And yeah.
So they're mostly your songs?
Yes. Yeah. I was okay. The main songwriter for the Shams. And at the time that we started, I got pregnant and had a baby. So it kind of, it made sense to kind of focus more on like feminine themes, like being a woman or being a young woman in the city. And that kind of, that was like what I was writing about. And that seemed like it made sense for it to be with, you know, a couple other women. And they were also wonderful, supportive friends with, you know, having a new baby and trying to deal with that back when like nobody I knew had kids. So it was really, I was really kind of alone in our, you know, in our social circles. There just weren't a lot of kids in the city at that time and among the bohemian crowd. So it was like a really sweet, you know, kind of family. I guess that's the thing, like music that I've played has always been sort of, it's like the idea of like having to audition somebody or do something pro, and like, you know, that didn't come till later, like going into a professional studio and trying to, you know, kind of work on this kind of more, professional level. It always seemed, especially being back in the 80s and 90s where there still was that kind of music business, it seemed like, oh, you know, this brass ring that you couldn't help but reach for because, you know, you wanted to quit your day job and be able to play music. But it was always kind of more like a gang of of friends or family that you were kind of, you know, you were going to be hanging out with them anyway. So.
Right. It's kind of homegrown.
It really was, by no design at all. You know, it was just like that. That was how it was.
So your releases from the Shams were in 1990, Quilt, and 1993, Seduzia EP. This is according to Wikipedia. Is that correct?
That sounds right. Yep. Oh, but we also put out a single in 1988, a 45, which was, you know, to put out a 45 in 1988 was kind of crazy and kind of an obscure like novelty item because it was actually all cassette at that point. Unless you were like one to be on a jukebox, because people just weren't really That was the point where vinyl was just kind of starting to go away.
One company called them Kasingles. Remember Kasingles?
Yes, I do. But so there was Bob Mould from Husker Du had started this label called Singles Only Label with a guy named Nicholas Hill, who kind of figured into later part of my history. But they, so they put out a single of The Shams. Sometimes I find them on Amazon or on, you know, if I find them, I buy them because I want to have as many as I can to like, I give them to people because it's just like,
that's great.
It's such a beautiful, perfect little, the song, Only a Dream that we ended up then re-recording for our album. And then, on the other side, a song by a friend of Amanda's named Faye Hart and, who was married to Steve Naive from, Elvis Costello's band.
He's my favorite.
Yeah. So that was a really sweet song. And it was just like a nice, it's just such a lovely little object, that 45.